I'm thinking of a small boy in the early 1960s living in an outer suburb of Melbourne in a large house. The boy belongs to a large Catholic family that fills the house almost to bursting. There would eventually be 9 children and 2 parents in the house. And the boy would, for a time, share a bedroom with 3 of his brothers. They had a bed in each corner of the room. Sometimes they would leap from bed to bed. And once one of the beds broke under this boy's joyful leaping. It was in this bedroom he learned to read by torchlight under his blanket at night, and sometimes he found comics or passages of writing that indicated there was a world out there beyond his suburb. He would lie in bed thinking of the strangeness of his home. At night, the girls went to their bedroom, the boys went to theirs, and his parents closed the door on their own bedroom. It was a kind of sorting. He went to school in the city. Sometimes he went by train, and sometimes his father drove him. Later, he would remember how much he loved and hated his father, as we all must, even if the hate is an abstract hate, or the love a buried thing. When his father drove him to school, there would be a car full of them, the girls going to their own school across the road from the boys' school. Always his father would be running late, and if the boy was late for school without an excuse or a note, he would be kept back in detention, and he would have to catch the late train home. He would remember the day his father glanced down at him sitting there in the front seat reading a book as his father swerved dangerously through the morning traffic, hopelessly late. His father saw that the boy's shoes were not polished. He said something to the boy and turned the car around, driving all the way back home, where the boy polished his scuffed shoes and listened to his father say that he might know how to read, he might know how to write, he might know how to pass exams, but he didn't know how to do something as simple as brush his shoes. Somehow, this lesson drew an aura around him and defined him. Why do we remember such things in this way? His father, all his siblings, have forgotten the incident. He has asked them, and they looked at him blankly when he recounted what he remembered. It might not have happened. It might just be that something like this could have happened or should have happened. That imagining something like this was required in the circumstances of his family to show him what he was and what he might become. The psychoanalyst Adam Phillips has written in an article on tantrums, quote, "There is something intrinsically and unavoidably humiliating about being a child. Every child has felt humiliated by his dependence on his parents, by his relative powerlessness in his relation to the people he needs. And everyone has been left feeling vengeful by this ineluctable diminishment." Unquote. There was also the time his father drove him to Sunbury, a long and difficult journey, to play a game of football. And when they arrived, the boy discovered he had left his football boots behind. And again, when he was older, his parents trusted him to go into the city by train with a pocketful of money to buy a new pair of Clark's school shoes. He bought the shoes and placed the new box with his new shoes inside the box beside him on the train journey home. He became absorbed in his book and forgot entirely about the shoes until he arrived home and his mother asked him where they were. The shoes were never found. And now he marvels at the power of the child to exert certain obscure revenges. The apparent incompetence of the absent-minded can be calculations of exquisite mindedness. The boy fell in love with the swooning poetry of John Keats, as Keats wrote his way to an early death at 26, and as the boy became an adolescent, subject to its aching pleasures of imagination and its usual fits of melancholy. But when the melancholy fit shall fall sudden from the heaven like a weeping cloud, and hides the green hill in an April shroud, then glut thy sorrow on a morning rose, or on the rainbow of the salt sand waves, or on the wealth of globed peonies, or, if thy mistress some rich anger shows, Imprison her soft hand and let her rave and feed deep, deep upon her peerless eyes. The hypnotic iambic pattern threatening to fall apart and then asserting itself again. Rhymes coming and going. And finally, the woman's mysterious anger. The girlfriend's mysterious anger. And the poet's inability to do more than hold her hand and gaze at the world. From these poems, the boy thought he had learned the almost secret neural music of speech, the connection that sound has to the chemical self, to the biological self. He wanted to do it too. He wanted to make poetry that did something like that. One of his English teachers gave the class the task of writing something creative each weekend. The boy would be full of tension and fright every weekend until the Sunday evening, when he would be forced to sit and write to the deadline, whatever came into his heart. One week, the teacher announced that he wanted to read aloud to the class the piece of writing that the boy had submitted. Just as the teacher began reading the story aloud, one boy in the class groaned. The teacher stopped, put the story away, and refused to go back to it. The story would never be read aloud. It would never be read by anyone but the teacher. The boy had learned something about the paradox of writing. Writing brings with it a puzzle that the boy will never be able to resolve. On the one hand, there is a small private self trying to write something personal that will be vividly particular and true, something that will somehow take hold of one wholly other sympathetic reader in that secret silent world a reader shares with a writer. On the other hand, there is no point to the ambition of this exercise if the words do not find their way into a book that is a public object, exposed to inevitable and understandable impatience, misunderstanding, ridicule, satire, acutely insightful contempt, or simply to groans. No wonder the writer lives in fear. For all its beauty, cleverness, and poise, Keats's Ode on Melancholy admits the shameful defeat, fear of death, and an inability to be much more than a spectator to his own life. So it takes equal measures of courage and foolishness, of vanity and selflessness, to write. Probably it will be a better choice to keep your shoes polished, to be at work on time, especially to be at your lectures on time, and probably not give away too much about your personal life, or even in the abstract, about your knowledge of how defeated and uncertain personal lives can be. In one of his last short stories called The Tale, Joseph Conrad had his storyteller speak of a war that was being, quote, carried on over the land, over the water, under the water, up in the air, and even under the ground. And many young men in it, mostly in wardrooms and mess rooms, used to say to each other, pardon the unparliamentary word, they used to say, it's a damned bad war, but it's better than no war at all. And this might be the writer's best slogan. It might be the best way a writer can approach his or her craft. Ready for defeat, knowing we're already defeated, but relishing the fact that defeat is at least a part of this world. We are at least here, the writer can say, and inside the main event. To continue for a moment more with military references, in Ben Fountain's remarkable recent novel, Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk, Fountain has his 20-year-old main character, Billy Lynn, reflect on his time as a soldier in Iraq. Billy Lynn is the public hero of a battle caught on video where his mentor, another soldier named Shroom, died. And this little passage goes like this. I'm a good soldier, he tells himself. Aren't I a good soldier? So what does it mean when a soldier feels this bad? Don't be scared, Shroom said, because you're going to be scared. So when you start to get scared, don't be scared. Billy has thought about this a lot, not just the Zen teaser of it, but what exactly does it mean to be scared out of your mind? Shroom again. Fear is the mother of all emotions. Before love, hate, spite, grief, rage, and all the rest, there was fear. And fear gave birth to them all. And as every combat soldier knows, there are as many incarnations and species of fear as the Eskimo language has words for snow. And strangely enough, Billy Lynn's forlorn and youthful answer to his many fears are just the same as the answers that Keats turned to. Billy Lynn also turns to his girlfriend, also learns passion for daily things. At the beginning of a poem in his first book of poetry, Paul Zweig wrote, "Afraid that I am not a poet." But then he went on in the next line to write, "Yet willing to write," and the next line, "even about that." So I think I might stop there and just exhort you, don't be scared to be scared as you put your pens to paper or your cursor to the blank screen.